From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump said today from the White House that he is feeling great and looking forward to the next presidential debate in Miami on October 15th.
The president was released yesterday from the hospital, and he's still contagious with COVID-19. And even though he's been downplaying his condition, medical experts say he should be closely monitored because it's too early to know whether his condition will deteriorate. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is chief of infectious diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Walensky joins us now. Welcome back.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
Doctor, the White House has not been as transparent about President Trump's condition as many would like. But from what you've heard and observed, what do you think the president's condition might be at this stage?
Right. So, you know, it's been very confusing because much of what he has been treated with is rather inconsistent with the symptoms and the general state in which they're describing. So, you know, generally, for example, we save dexamethasone for people who are in a much more severe state than A, the image he's trying to portray, and B, the way he actually, quite frankly, looks. I can say that I was encouraged when I saw the six-minute Twitter video. He certainly did not look like he had labored breathing. He was speaking in full sentences. He didn't cough. That's all presuming that there were no edits to that. I also can say when he exited the helicopter last evening, he, you know, went up the stairs with a pretty good stride. He didn't take pauses at each step. So all of those were indications to me that he seemed to be breathing reasonably well. I don't know whether he received oxygen on the flight or whether he needed it when he reached the top of the stairs. But he didn't look particularly labored either climbing the stairs or at the top.
The next week will be a critical time frame for the president's recovery. What might happen during this period?
You know, so I think we really need to see how he does. We haven't gotten a lot of information about how he was doing during the early period of time. And in fact, we don't really exactly know when his course of illness started. We have this sense that he had mild symptoms on Wednesday, maybe Thursday. And so he's probably four or five days into his course right now. Somewhere in the 5 to 11 days after symptoms start is when people can start progressing to a more severe pneumonia. And so we certainly hope that that wouldn't happen, but that would be something to watch out for. He also has gotten a lot of interventions early. So the monoclonal antibody is one intervention that he received at the White House before going to Walter Reed that generally decreases the duration of symptoms. So we might be in a situation where he could fare quite well having received those interventions.
There's also the latest news from the CDC, which has updated its guidance, and it confirms that the virus can spread through airborne transmission. That means particles remain in the air even after people have left the area. And among those who are further than 6 feet apart, keeping all of this in mind, what should the president's isolation plan look like?
Well, you know, for those of us who are interested in the infection control measures associated with this virus, there have been numerous mishaps. What you would expect if infection control measures were being upheld is that the president would be in isolation and not emerge from isolation until 10 days post his initial symptoms. That's 10 days after his initial symptoms. They're being reported as Wednesday or Thursday. And at least 24 hours without any symptoms.
As you've really laid out here, it's important to note that we're still learning about COVID-19 every day in terms of treatments and also in terms of the effectiveness and safety of potential vaccines. The White House has now blocked the FDA's new vaccine guidelines, which created a 2-month window where researchers could watch for adverse effects among study volunteers. That would have pushed the release past Election Day. As a medical professional, what's your reaction to the White House insisting on an earlier release? What should the public understand about what's happening here?
I think ultimately the success of this vaccine is going to depend on public trust, their ability to receive it, and their desire to have it. And any intervention that is deemed political beyond the scientists will only serve to undermine any value that the vaccine has, because if we don't have people taking it, it will be useless. And so I really urge to let the scientists do the incredible work that they are doing to make sure that they can bring a safe and effective vaccine forward that the public can trust.
That's Dr. Rochelle Walensky, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Massachusetts General Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, many people watched the president's photo op last night at the White House with astonishment. In fact, with everything that's happened in the last week, the word unprecedented comes to mind. So let's bring in Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Nice to be with you.
Well, let's start with that very theatrical return to the White House last night that we were just hearing about. The video shows the president walking up the steps. He pauses, takes his masks off, and then gives two thumbs up. Dr. Walensky didn't feel that he was gasping for air, but many people did as they watched that video. What did you make of what you saw?
Well, it reflected a lot of the limits of his administration's response to the policy. He was, in some ways, with his tweet, denying the seriousness and severity of the disease, wasn't totally being transparent about his condition, and he was defying basic public health protocol right now. And he's not even clearly protecting those around him, not just leaders, but staff. So what he saw as a show of strength in my mind was just the opposite and pointed to some of the problems with the presidency right now.
Well, when it comes to that show of strength, it seems like this entire episode has been about the image that the president wants to present. He went to Walter Reed on Friday. His doctors did these briefings, which seemed designed to assure everyone that he was fine rather than provide clarity on his condition. He did that motorcade to greet supporters outside Walter Reed. And then yesterday he tweeted he was going home to the White House even before his doctors came out and said that he was going to be leaving the hospital. What does that all add up to you?
Well, it's what his presidency has been about from the start. He's someone who always thinks about how things will look either on the television screen or your computer screen. And that's how he guides a lot of his action. But in this case, it isn't just about him. It's not about just protecting his image. The question people have and the concern is it's also about our public health response to the crisis, and that by doing this, he fuels the problems that have not allowed us to reopen safely. And so that's a limit of someone who only makes that calculation in many decisions.
The president is obviously not the first president who's been concerned about his image. What comes to mind for you from the past?
Sure. We've had examples from JFK, John F. Kennedy, not allowing the public to know all the details about his health problems, to Ronald Reagan, who famously worked with his advisors on a line of the day, where every day was scripted around a particular theme. So presidents have often thought about their image and they've thought about what they project. But the important part is they balance that with other factors, the need to govern, the need to conduct the presidency in a certain way. And if those are wiped away, then you're in a more dangerous situation.
A line of the day for Reagan, that was even before 24-hour news or Twitter. So is there something to be said, Julian, for a president who does maintain that image that everything is all right or is going to be all right, even if it isn't?
Well, that doesn't work if things aren't all right, because then there's just the disconnect between what the president is doing and what many people are experiencing. So if you're in a moment when you have this number of people who have died from a disease and so many of our institutions just hanging in the balance until we get through this, you can't just say I'm projecting an image of being okay. Then it actually is just not responding to the very real fears and needs of the population. It's like being in a terrible quagmire overseas in a war and just denying that it's even happening or that anything's going wrong. That doesn't actually help the nation.
Speaking of our institutions being in the balance, we are officially just 4 weeks away from Election Day. People are voting already, but that is the day that we may at least have some results. There will be a Supreme Court confirmation fight between now and then. The president has a deadly disease. There's a vice presidential debate tomorrow. Is there anything you can think of from history that is quite like this moment?
Not exactly, but look, there are elections in the middle of crises. 1864, we have a civil war going on. 1944, Franklin Roosevelt is very ill and we're still in World War II. 1968, we had an election where the nation was torn apart by the seams with Vietnam and civil rights. But just because there's other turbulent elections doesn't mean this one isn't very fraught. And I think it is. And I think this falls in that long list.
And do you agree with, I would say, probably both President Trump and Vice President Biden that the future of the entire country is at stake in this election?
Look, if you have an election where our public health, our economy, and our democratic institutions are all going to be profoundly affected by the victor, I think it adds up to an election where almost everything is at stake.
Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Always great to talk with you, Julian. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
This has been a very difficult year for migrant farm workers. Their work in the nation's fields is already hard, but in 2020, they're also dealing with the pandemic and the wildfires on the West Coast. Those fires have created extremely unhealthy air quality for anyone working outside. Monica Ramirez has been thinking a lot about this. She's the president and founder of the organization Justice for Migrant Women, and she joins us via Skype. Monica, welcome. And can you first tell us a little about the farm worker population? Who are they and where do they come from?
Yes, so there are 2 to 3 million farm workers in our country. The majority of farm workers in our nation are Latinx, the overwhelming majority of those being of Mexican and Mexican-American descent. We do have farm workers here in the United States that are not immigrants, that are U.S. born. We have, you know, about 1 million farm workers in our nation are women. We do have farm worker children who are working in the fields. We don't have a great statistic to reflect how many children are working in the fields, but there are thousands of kids who work in the fields alongside their families. The other thing I think it's important for people to understand is that farm workers, some of them are migratory, meaning that they move from place to place, from city to city or state to state. But there also are seasonal farm workers, which are people who live in a community year round and then engage in agricultural labor during the seasons, depending on what fruits or vegetables are available to pick. And in our nation, we do have, guest workers who come from Mexico and other countries to work on temporary agricultural visas in states around our nation.
What's being done for these workers right now as they do their jobs under these difficult conditions, not just the wildfires, but also in the pandemic?
People have come together to create funds to provide financial relief. Our organization, Justice for Migrant Women, has raised more than $3 million that we've dispersed to farm worker serving organizations around the country to help get direct aid to community members, along with food and hand sanitizer and masks and things of that nature. Our organizations are also working really hard to make policymakers understand what it is that farm workers are confronting as they consider policy proposals that the farm worker community will not be left behind. The other thing is that efforts are now being made to ensure that farm worker children are receiving not only PPE, you know, the face masks that they need to be able to go to the daycare or to be able to go to school, but many are also working to ensure that our children are able to participate in their school lessons. Many community members don't have access to broadband and they don't have computers. And so we've been advocating to ensure that as lawmakers and as school systems consider what will be put in place where virtual learning is happening, that there's consideration given to farm worker children who unfortunately had a very difficult time in the spring keeping up and engaging in continuing their studies because they didn't have what they needed to be able to do so. So as new needs arise, we've been trying to stay nimble in order to shift to be able to help, meet those needs as well.
This is personal for you because you come from a family of farm workers.
That's right. You know, I am the daughter and granddaughter of migrant farm workers. My family used to travel the migrant stream around our country picking crops. And my father started working when he was 8 years old, picking cotton alongside his siblings and my grandparents. And both sides of my family, my mother's side and my father's side, eventually migrated to Ohio, where they settled out of the migrant stream. And because of the fact that they were able to settle out of the migrant stream, myself and my siblings were the first generation and my family not to migrate for the purposes of work. But even still, I was raised in a rural community where I still live today. And the issues and concerns related to the farm worker community have always been top of mind. You know, my parents raised us to understand some of the issues that existed when they worked in the fields. And unfortunately, many of those issues are the same problems that farm workers across our country are facing today.
I said this was personal for you, but really your assertion is that it should be personal for all of us. What do you want Americans who may not ever think about where their food comes from to know about this?
That's absolutely right. We all need to care about the well-being of farm workers because farm workers feed us. And I want everyday people who maybe don't have the personal connection that I have to understand that we are touched by farm workers every day because we do eat. And farm workers in our nation have been denied the basic rights and protections that other workers have been afforded for more than 80 years. And during this time when farm workers have been deemed essential workers, they've not been extended essential rights and benefits. So my hope is that the everyday consumer will understand farm workers should have the same basic rights as other workers. And during this pandemic, we should ensure that they are getting the same kinds of care, benefits, resources, and protections as other essential workers. And so my plea to people across our country is to help tell the stories of the people who feed us and ensure that the political leaders understand that we all care about their well-being and that we all want our country to do better by them.
Monica Ramirez is president and founder of Justice for Migrant Women. Monica, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
2020 was supposed to be a turning point for those trying to ban single-use plastics like grocery bags. 8 states, including California and New York, and hundreds of local governments had approved bans on plastic bags. And federal legislation was introduced to reduce certain single-use plastic products. But many of those plastic bag bans have been put on hold during this pandemic. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
It's not easy to create a new habit, like bringing your own bags to buy groceries, even for someone like Dan Donovan. He's spokesman for Pittsburgh-based Giant Eagle and has been working to reduce single-use plastic bags at the regional supermarket chain.
But even myself, I can't tell you the number of times that I've walked into a Giant Eagle and thought, shucks, I forgot my bags back in my car.
In January, Giant Eagle made an effort to help people remember. It offered incentives to customers with reusable bags, with a goal to eliminate single-use plastic bags in all its stores by 2025. A number of the chain stores in Pittsburgh and Ohio started a pilot program in January that removed plastic bags from checkouts.
We actually helped eliminate 20 million single-use plastic bags from entering our landfills or otherwise cluttering our community. So we're very excited about that.
But when COVID-19 hit in February and March, things changed.
And all of us were just uncertain. I mean, we're just concerned and we were scared, to be quite frank. So at Giant Eagle, you know, it became about prioritizing. We brought the plastic bags back in and we asked customers not to bring in their own reusable bags.
Other supermarket chains did the same. States, including California, New York, and New Hampshire, backed off bans on certain single-use plastics, as did many cities like Philadelphia and Chicago. Reusables were being associated with the possible spread of the virus, while single-use plastics seemed cleaner and less likely to carry disease. Researcher Robert Hale says this general idea by many people was not an accident.
There was a fairly organized campaign among plastic manufacturers and related industries to basically infer that reusable plastics did indeed present some sort of COVID-related health risk.
Hale is a professor in environmental chemistry at the Virginia Institute of Marine Science. He points to a well-publicized letter by the Plastics Industry Association, which asked the Centers for Disease Control to speak out against bans on single-use plastics as a public safety risk. The letter said reusable bags can carry viruses and bacteria that can spread throughout a store in, quote, study after study after study.
But when you say study after study after study, you start thinking, well, there's, you know, a basket full of them. Well, yeah, there were 3.
In an opinion piece he wrote in the journal Environmental Health and Technology, Hale said that none of the studies were specifically relevant to the transmission of coronavirus.
I think these studies that are cited point out that there is a potential issue from reusable bags, but it's probably not so much from COVID, but the fact that you need to wash these things every once in a while and don't put your gym socks in with your groceries.
The CDC does not have specific guidance on reusable grocery store bags. The Plastics Industry Association declined to comment for the story, but there's no specific research yet on whether coronavirus can live on reusable bags.
Seems to be a very unlikely route of transmission.
Dr. Jody Sherman is Associate Professor of Epidemiology at Yale School of Public Health. She's one of more than 115 public health experts, including virologists and food packaging safety specialists, who signed a statement on this issue, which was released by Greenpeace USA. It assures retailers and consumers that single-use plastics are not safer than reusables to prevent spread of coronavirus.
So really what we have are case reports and case studies. I know of none that have tied anywhere in the world an outbreak or transmission of SARS-CoV-2 through reusable bags.
Meanwhile, California has reinstated its plastic bag ban, and New York is expected to start enforcing its ban this month. In Pennsylvania, Wendell Young leads the local union that represents more than 20,000 supermarket workers, including cashiers and baggers at Giant Eagle. Young says the initial fear of reusable bags has been tempered with more information.
I'm okay with customers using reusable bags. We are, as a union, okay with that. We just don't want our members handling them. We're not going to do it because we don't know how they were cared for. We don't know what those bags might be carrying with them.
Some grocery chains have already started allowing customers to bring in reusable bags again, including Giant Eagle, which welcomed them back last month. Customers with reusable bags are asked to use self-checkout and bag their own groceries. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
The Department of Justice is preparing to file a major antitrust lawsuit against Google as soon as this week, just as Congress is expected to publish its long-anticipated report on the future of big tech. Today, a House committee again delayed the release of its report on Amazon, Apple, Facebook, and Google owner Alphabet. But reports suggest it could go as far as calling for some of those companies to be broken up. Kat Zagreski covers technology policy for The Washington Post and joins us now. Hi, Kat.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Yes. So one of the members of the committee, Representative Ken Buck, Republican of Colorado, told Reuters that the report contains what he called a thinly veiled call to break up the companies. What are you hearing about what the antitrust subcommittee is likely to recommend?
So this report caps off a 15-month investigation into the practices of these companies, and we've heard directly from the lawmakers at recent hearings that the Democrats on the committee believe that some of these companies have acted as monopolies and may need to be broken up to address that. But as you mentioned, Republicans, including Ken Buck, have raised concerns that some of the measures that Democrats want might go too far and could, you know, be damaging to the economy.
Can we talk a little bit about what breaking up these companies might actually look like? Facebook also owns Instagram and WhatsApp. Google owns YouTube and makes Android phones. Amazon has a massive cloud computing operation in addition to its e-commerce business. Do we know which of those companies is most at risk of some kind of antitrust action?
I think all four of these companies are very much in the antitrust spotlight at this moment. We know that all four of the CEOs were hauled into Congress for a major hearing in July. But, you know, I think Facebook particularly has come under intense scrutiny in Washington. And as you mentioned, there's a lot of questions, particularly from this committee, about Facebook's acquisitions of Instagram and WhatsApp. At the time, you know, these were small companies and federal regulators signed off, gave these deals a green light. But lawmakers, now looking back at how Facebook has grown in recent years, are suggesting that based on evidence they've collected in the past few months of this investigation, it may be time to review those deals. Really, I think all of these companies are under a harsh spotlight, but the antitrust problems with each one are a little bit different. So I think we'll see that this report is going to be very long and get into a lot of the specific issues with each company.
We also learned last week that the CEOs of Facebook and Google and Twitter will testify again before Congress just 6 days before the election. What are they likely to be asked about then, and how could the election affect where these antitrust investigations go next?
So this hearing will likely set up another high-profile showdown between Washington and the Silicon Valley companies. As we get so close to the election, there's going to be a lot of questions about how the companies handle posts from the candidates, particularly Trump, who recently has been spreading misinformation about the integrity of the election and now is downplaying the severity of the coronavirus on these services. And so I think we're going to see a pretty intense grilling from both political parties about how the CEOs of Facebook, Google, and Twitter are handling that.
That's Kat Zagreski, technology policy reporter for The Washington Post and author of the Technology 202 newsletter. Thank you, Kat.
Thank you.
More Americans than ever are expected to vote by mail this year, but with many states that typically rely on in-person voting now gearing up for major vote-by-mail operations, election experts don't expect a smooth process. They're worried about whether voters will have the right information, how long it'll take to count ballots, and how many people might ultimately be disqualified. We're joined now by Amber McReynolds, CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute, a nonpartisan organization. She's also the former director of elections for Denver, Colorado. Amber McReynolds, how many people do you expect to see voting by mail this year?
Yeah, many already are. And, you know, what we've seen this year is record interest in voting by mail. And, you know, part of that is the pandemic, but part of that honestly was on par with the trend that we've seen over the last 20 years or so, where we've seen this significant interest and growth in voting by mail, and more voters are choosing that method. And we're certainly seeing that this year in record numbers.
One of the big concerns with voting by mail is that some ballots end up getting disqualified. In the 2016 election, 1% of mail-in ballots were disqualified. Do you expect a number like that, a percentage like that, or even higher this year?
That's usually about what we see. However, what I would say is that we've also seen this year a few legislative changes as well as litigation that has modified some of the reasons for rejection. So, for instance, usually voters get disqualified because their ballot's late. And we've actually seen a lot of states move to postmark. And so that's going to take that number of disqualifications down. And then, you know, states have learned lessons from the primary on the importance of cure processes and making sure that if a voter's signature, for instance, is disqualified, that they have a chance to cure that. That's also really important. And usually we see a higher cure rate in a contested or, you know, highly interested election. So a presidential election usually does bring more people to ensure that their ballot gets cured.
Well, how does that work? What kind of recourse exists for a voter whose ballot is rejected? Do they find out? Does somebody call them up and say, by the way, your ballot was rejected. The signature doesn't match. Do you want to come down here and deal with it? Or is it just thrown out and that's the end of it?
So it varies by state. However, most states offer a cure process. And the best version of that is, for instance, in a state like Colorado, and I'll just use Denver as an example. In Denver, you get they have a full ballot tracking system. So you know where your ballot is at every moment. And if there's an issue, you literally get a text or an email the moment that issue arises. And then they say, here's your options to cure. And one of those options includes a text to cure process where you can literally sign the affidavit and provide the copy of your ID over text message. Other types of system include letters, sometimes phone calling, but the voter is notified in one method or another. A lot of states allow email notification. It just depends on the state and what the process looks like.
Is there something, though, that you would tell voters right now if they are going to vote by mail to make sure that they're doing everything that they ought to be doing and will be able to cure if there's a problem with their ballot?
Absolutely. So first and foremost is to follow the instructions. So if it says on the ballot, fill in the oval. And if it says user black or blue pen, do that. And then on the envelope, if you are going to vote by mail, there is a place for you to sign. You need to make sure you sign where that's required and then fill out any other information on the affidavit, because that's, you know, certainly important for election officials to validate that your ballot is from you. And then if you're in a state like Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania is on an island in that they, right now, they reject mail ballots if the inner secrecy envelope is not included. Mm-hmm. So in Pennsylvania, it's really, really important to include that secrecy because there's no cure process for that either. Pennsylvania is a particularly problematic state, and they're the only ones that have this provision where it's rejected if it's not present.
Well, and in fact, the state Supreme Court in Pennsylvania also ruled that the state can't start counting until Election Day and only has 3 days to finish. Obviously, a lot of people are going to be voting by mail this year. Are you concerned about that timeline in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I mean, Pennsylvania, along with Michigan and Wisconsin, have, you know, basically it's Election Day before they can start handling the ballots. Michigan made a slight modification that what we expect will be signed into law, but they still have very little time. And the problem with that is that when you do have more mail ballots, election officials need more time to extract the ballots out of the envelope, flatten them, prep them for counting, do signature verification. There's multiple steps. And so those states have particularly problematic laws. And unfortunately, the legislative bodies have not acted upon the request of the election officials in all of those states that have asked for more time. It is going to be a, you know, rush to the finish. And it's just unfortunate that the legislative bodies have not gone with the advice of the election officials in the states.
What about Texas? The governor there has chosen to make it, looks like, about as hard as possible to drop off ballots. There will only be one drop-off location per county. Now, you could still mail them in, I suppose. But in Harris County, which is larger in population than the state of Rhode Island, has 4 million residents, there'd only be one drop-off box. What do you think the effect of that is going to be?
Well, I honestly, that Texas executive order that came from Governor Abbott was the most egregious example of trying to prevent people from voting that I have seen this year. And there's been a lot of examples of some pretty awful things, but that one was the worst. And the reason why is drop boxes are critical to a vote by mail program and being successful. And voters like to drop off their ballot in person. We know that from various studies, and they sometimes trust that more than it going through the mail process. It's actually more secure than even going through the mail because you're giving it directly to your local election official. And so it's very peculiar that he did this. It's also very peculiar when you think about Texas because they already limit vote by mail based on your age. So if you're over 65, you can get a mail ballot without an excuse. If you're under 65, you have to provide an excuse. So in Texas, a lot of people that are over the age of 65 vote by mail because they can. And it's incredible that he would limit these options in the middle of a pandemic like this, and certainly against the advice and the requests from county officials who also had prepared and planned and already communicated Dropbox options and were set to kick those off. So it seems to be a very political move. And, you know, Texas already ranks at the bottom of the totem pole in terms of turnout. So now they've, you know, done something else to put themselves even lower.
And what about South Carolina? Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed South Carolina Republicans to restore a requirement that each absentee ballot has a witness signature. Now, it doesn't apply to the ones that have already been sent, but what is the effect of that rule going to be, do you think?
Well, witness signatures are kind of they're a very outdated provision, and they still exist in some states. And, you know, we were happy that South Carolina was going to remove that. And then to have that reversed in the middle of the election when people are already voting is a problem. I mean, people have already submitted their ballots. And so now they're setting up a different process for vote by mail voters that submit their ballot now. And, you know, that anytime you create inconsistencies like that in the election process, it can be problematic. So, you know, it's disappointing to see the Supreme Court make a ruling like that so late in the game, and it will likely impact voters. I mean, there will be rejections because of that ruling.
What are you most concerned about right now? I mean, we've talked about some specifics, but what is your nightmare November scenario?
Oh, I have quite a few. since I ran elections for so long, I think about all of the different things that could go wrong because it is very much about risk mitigation. You know, one of the things that I think is still problematic, it was problematic in 2016 and 2018, and now it's at a level that I've never seen before, is mis and disinformation. You know, it's daily that states are having to put out responses to just misleading or bad information about the election process overall. So that continues to be a problem. And I think it's one of our greatest challenges, actually. And then the second thing is, you know, disruptions on election day overall. And, you know, we've seen examples of that previously. But, you know, whether it be protests or some other interruption that impacts voters, I worry about that. I worry about the trust that voters have in the process, and anything that disrupts their ability to vote is problematic. And so those two things are my biggest concern.
That is Amber McReynolds, who is CEO of the National Vote at Home Institute. That's a nonpartisan nonprofit. And we will link you to their website at hereandnow.org, where you can find all kinds of information about voting by mail. Amber McReynolds, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Supreme Court Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito are questioning the court's 2015 decision to make same-sex marriage a constitutional right. The two justices issued their opinion Monday during a case concerning Kim Davis, a Kentucky county clerk who had been sued for refusing to give out marriage licenses to same-sex couples after same-sex marriage was made the law of the land. The Supreme Court turned down her appeal yesterday. Let's bring in Dahlia Lithwick, who writes about the courts and law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. Hi, Dahlia.
Hi, Tanya.
So Thomas and Alito agreed that the court made the right decision to deny Davis's appeal, but they used this opportunity to write a four-page opinion denouncing the damage they say the 2015 decision did to religious freedom. What are they arguing?
Yeah, this was interesting. They kind of sent up a flare. It wasn't necessary to do this, so they added to the decision to bat the case away. And Justice Thomas wrote, with Alito concurring, that Obergefell, quote, enables courts and governments to brand religious adherents who believe that marriage is between one man and one woman as bigots. So in effect, what they're saying is by creating a constitutional right to marriage in Obergefell, the court actually enabled religious Americans like Kim Davis to be victims of claims of religious bigotry.
How are members of the LGBTQ community and others responding to this?
Well, I think they see the flare as sending up a call to essentially bring cases to reverse Obergefell, and they're very worried. James Obergefell, he was the plaintiff in that case, said the opinion was, quote, disturbing and unsettling, and said that Thomas and Alito seem to be implying that the freedom of religion for other people carries more weight, is more important than all other civil rights. And I think other LGBTQ groups have echoed that sentiment.
This 2015 decision was decided by a 5-4 vote. Are Alito and Thomas signaling that they want to revisit the ruling? And does Amy Coney Barrett's pending confirmation put that decision in jeopardy?
Yeah, I think that really for Justices Thomas and Alito to signal right before an election, by the way, in which SCOTUS is front and center for voters, an invitation to go ahead and invalidate Obergefell and other gay rights generally seems to be the intent. Indiana has already asked the Supreme Court to uphold a law that refuses to put both names of a same-sex couple on a birth certificate. So those cases are in the pipeline. As for Amy Coney Barrett, we just know that in a lecture she gave in 2016, she roundly defended the dissenters in Obergefell and said the courts are not the place to be deciding this and that the majority was wrong.
There's also something else. In November, the justices are set to hear arguments about the role of religion in excluding same-sex parents from a foster care program. How is yesterday's opinion by Thomas and Alito expected to inform that case?
Yeah, that's a big ticket case that's coming quickly. The city of Philadelphia had stopped placing children with this agency, Catholic Social Services, because they had a policy against placing kids with same-sex couples. They've lost at the Third Circuit. The court will be hearing it. And I think, in effect, it continues a trend that has been ongoing for the last few years, where the court hands out some big wins for LGBTQ rights, including last year in the Title VII case, but then even bigger wins for religious objectors like the cake baker, like the Little Sisters of the Poor last year, enabling religious objectors to get out from under civil rights laws.
One more thing, abortion is another key issue for religious conservatives, as Coney Barrett's nomination raises fears that a conservative majority on the court could actually lead to the overturning of Roe versus Wade. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden said yesterday that if that were to happen, he would pass legislation making Roe the law of the land. Here's Biden at a town hall in Miami last night.
Number one, we don't know exactly what she will do, although the expectation is that she may very well move to overrule Roe. But the only responsible response to that would be to pass legislation making Roe the law of the land.
With the 30 seconds or so I have with you, would passing legislation supporting abortion rights be possible if Biden wins in November?
I think it's possible, and Kamala Harris has been really explicit about the kinds of laws she wants to pass to bolster Roe, but I think those laws require a Congress that's on board. It's not clear you have that, or that a Supreme Court that's 6-3 wouldn't go ahead and strike that down, too.
That's Slate reporter Dahlia Lithwick, host of the podcast Amicus. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.